Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
We have never been this close.
So close to the goal line for real, comprehensive health reform.
We've never had such broad agreement on what needs to be done. And because we're so close to real reform, suddenly the special interests are doing what they always do, which is just try to scare the heck out of people.
President Obama back in campaign mode yesterday, rallying support for health insurance reform in advance of Congress returning to work today for the home stretch of trying to pass a historic health reform bill. We will pick up right where we left off last week with a multitude of voices on the health reform issue. Last week, if you were out on vacation or something, we had Congressman Henry Waxman, commentator Betsy McCoy, a spokesman from the Pharmaceutical Industry Association, and Howard Dean's co-author Igor Volsky. So let's dive right back in now with New York Times columnist David Brooks as our first healthcare reform guest for this week. In his column on Friday, he wished he could have just 1 hour with the president before Mr. Obama gives his big speech on the issue before a joint session of Congress and all the TV cameras tomorrow night. Hi, David. Welcome back to WNYC.
It's good to be with you again, Brian.
And if you had that hour, you would focus on health care as the monster that's devouring our economy, I gather.
Yeah, well, that's been my focus. First, let me correct something the president said in that little snippet there.
Yeah.
He said all the special interests were against him. One of the big differences this time is the special interests are on the whole for him. I think Big Pharma is spending $120 million on TV ads, which is more than John McCain spent on his whole presidential race. So that's one big difference. But yeah, basically, my focus has been on cost control. This issue is so complicated. I decided I would take one part. And there are two main goals, obviously. One is to expand coverage. The other is to control costs, because the runaway health care costs are damaging wages, bankrupting the country, leading to these incredible deficits. And I guess that's been the part of the health care reform that really hasn't worked out so well. According to the Congressional Budget Office, the bill that has come out of the House, or is about to, or may come out of the House, would increase health care inflation by 8% in 2019. And we just can't afford 8% annual increases in health care costs. So the expanding coverage is part of it. They're doing reasonably well. Controlling costs is the part they're not doing so well.
And as how that relates to the details of the plan and how it gets sold, you wrote in your column that the president went off the rails when he promised everyone who likes our current insurance status that we would get to keep exactly what we have. You think that was a bad thing to promise?
Well, I understand why he did it, but there's always been a tension. He's always campaigned very effectively and very well on this fundamental proposition that our healthcare system is fundamentally screwed up, that the incentives are to give more care, not more services, but not better care. And he said many times that we have this system that produces huge costs, which don't actually produce benefits to people. So he's made this very comprehensive critique of the current system. And then he goes and says, well, 80% of you, or whatever it is, who like what you have, nothing's going to change for you. And so he's not going to change the fee-for-service structure of the system. He's not going to change the employer-based nature of the system. And so that's always been a tension, the comprehensive critique built on top. And then he goes ahead and basically preserves the status quo. So I'd like to see him challenge the status quo. So politically, I completely understand why he made that promise, because one of the lessons of Clinton Care was that there are a lot of people who are really happy. You cannot threaten them. You can't fundamentally change the system.
That,
but if you don't fundamentally change the system, you don't fundamentally solve the problem.
So there's that lesson from Clinton Care, and also politically, many of the attacks from the right have been precisely on that point. Obamacare will force you into a government plan immediately or gradually. It'll force insurance companies to abandon the plans they now offer because there'll be minimum benefit requirements. It'll tax the best employer-provided insurance available today, which means that might no longer be offered to you. So that's exactly what the Republicans and even many of the centrist Democrats are shouting the loudest about, isn't it?
Yes. You know, one of the things that's occurred to me is we think we have a big debate, but we have a, in some sense, a consensus, and the consensus is to preserve the status quo. The president wants to preserve it by just not changing it. The Republicans want to preserve it by any time there's even the slightest hint of a change in some of the incentives or some of the Medicare costs or even the so-called death panels. They go crazy. And so the Republicans are basically preserving the status quo by grossly exaggerating and getting hysterical about even the tiny minor changes that are in some of the bills or some of the ideas that are floating around. So that makes it extremely likely that we're going to preserve the status quo, which won't solve the problems.
So your fear is, and my guest is New York Times columnist David Brooks, if you're just joining us, previewing the president's health care speech tomorrow night, your fear is that the compromises the president will make will fail to address what you consider the biggest underlying cause of that status quo, perverse incentives to spend more money, I guess because we don't pay for most of our health care out of pocket. Talk about that. Do you want a system with less insurance altogether, less third-party payment, and more bills directly to the patient?
Essentially, I want some cost consciousness, yes, on the part of the patient. That's essentially the system. And I recommended the cover story in the Current Atlantic Monthly, which is a very good cover story. And I think it makes a persuasive case, and I've been persuaded over the course of this debate.
Yes, and by the way, we have an invitation into that author, so hopefully later in the week, but go ahead.
He's very smart. There are basically two ways to control costs. One is this very centralized approach where you have a central body, a Federal Reserve Board of Healthcare, which basically dictates what's going to be done and what's not going to be done, and you try to get rid of the stuff that's not cost-effective. The other way is to create a more effective market where people really see the costs and get to have some say, not in the individual, whether you're going to get this operation or that operation. Obviously, you're in a time of stress. You can't make that call. But what plan you sort of buy into. And that would create a better system of incentives for people to deliver care and not just more and more services, more and more tests. So I'm more persuaded that we need the latter. But you're essentially blowing up the current system where people don't have to face the choices of the consequences of their choices,
right,
and get to spend somebody else's money.
Right. But it's blowing up the system in a particular direction. Some people want to blow up the system and try a universal single-payer plan. What you're proposing is not to reduce it all to left-right, but the most conservative system of all, isn't it? Because while the rest of the industrialized world has universal systems where they ration centrally to make sure everyone gets the basics, and it is more or less government-driven, you want us to have to ration individually with the staggering inequalities that would produce. Is that a fair way to look at it?
No, I don't think so. Not necessarily with the staggering inequalities, because, first of all, you'd put everybody in the system. You'd subsidize everybody so everybody can afford to be in the system. And I'm not quite sure it's fair to say it's left-right. If you look at some of the things that I think are essential, and the thing I think is most essential, is getting rid of the tax exemption on health care benefits, which outrageously favors the upper middle class and the upper class because they get these huge benefits and their employers don't have to pay any taxes on it. And if you got rid of that, that would be a tremendous progressive reform. And then if you look at some of the
But that would wind up, and let me just interrupt for a second, because that would wind up in less health insurance altogether, wouldn't it? Because then the incentive would be there to skimp on health insurance because it costs the employer or costs the employee compared to what we even have today.
Right, which is why you have to give a tax credit. I think one of the things that I think is sitting out there, which is a good starting point, and I wouldn't agree with all of it, is this thing called the Wyden-Bennett bill. Ron Wyden, senator from Oregon, a Democrat, Robert Bennett, a senator from Utah, a Republican, have a plan which essentially, to simplify, you'd cash out the employer benefit, and then they'd give you the money. You could have a choice of highly regulated plans. They would give people money who aren't in the current system to also have this choice. And then you have this choice combined with universality, and the Congressional Budget Office has ruled that's cost-effective. And I think that's the model that I think is the best model to start with. And there are other people who can talk with great length and in great detail on how you can structure and how current states and other governments have structured this sort of plan. Alan Entoven at Stanford is one of the leading economists on this. And to me, that's the best way to go.
So I see a kind of liberal paradox and kind of conservative paradox in the healthcare debate right now, and they do both have to do with money. Liberals, including the president, say we need to spend more on healthcare to cover the uninsured and all those awful copays and deductibles that we all hate, and we have to cut costs. So people get confused and anxious. Are they going to spend more on me or less on me? And then conservatives say the government spends too much on health care. They've got to spend less taxpayer money. And then in the next breath, oh, my God, the government's going to ration your health care. So there's this sort of money-driven paradox on both sides, it seems to me, that's leaving people really, really confused and anxious.
Right, and the brutal truth is, one, we are going to ration health care. We are rationing now in different ways, but we're always going to ration health care. And two, we are going to cut costs, and we're going to have to cut government costs because it's simply unaffordable to have a government health care system that is, it's not only bankrupting the country, it squeezes out all other priorities. That if you want money for education, you want money for the environment, the health care spending in the federal budget is just squeezing that all out. And, you know, I interview people in the White House, and I try to raise my gloom and doom scenarios, and they all agree with it. But then, you know, no politician wants to prescribe pain. And the paradox is both parties are hypocrisies both parties are engaged in are an effort to curry favor with the public. And essentially, to some extent, it's all our problems because we want the most expensive care, and we don't want to pay for it, and the politicians are trying to curry to that.
David Brooks with me for another few minutes on WNYC. So really, neither party is debating this right now on the terms that you would like to see, as you've been laying it out here this morning. In fact, you go so far in your Friday column as to refer to the debate over a public plan or private cooperatives as a distraction. On the terms that this is being debated, isn't that fundamental to what kind of health insurance future we're going to have?
Well, I don't think so. I mean, I'm not viscerally for or against the public plan. If the Congressional Budget Office said the public plan would save some small amount of money, and if it would do that, then I'm fine with the public plan and if it would really compete fairly with the private plans. But it's a small amount of money. It might have been like $15 billion over 10 years or something. So why is it central? Various people have made this point. Why is the public plan or not public plan become so central to debate when there are many, many other issues just as important or more important? And the answer is it's very easy to polarize that. The public plan is either socialism or getting at the healthcare industry. And so it's the most simplistic, polarized part of this debate. And as a result, it's become the flashpoint. But it's not the right flashpoint. I should say, by the way, you don't have to, you know, I sound like I want some plan that's far out in right or left field that is completely politically impossible because it would make people suffer. But there are a series of very realistic proposals put up by the Brookings Institution, including capping the employer health deduction, that are in embryo form in all the current bills, and it'd be a question of strengthening these pilot programs which are in the current bills. So one more example, comparative advantage. That's where we decide what really works, and then we try to insist on that. In the current bills, you can do research to find out what treatments really work, but you can't implement those research because the special interest didn't want that. So we should try to implement what the research findings are. And that's not a huge step away from the status quo. And I should also say, also after I wrote that column, uh-huh, I got a call from various Obama officials, and they said, oh, he's way ahead of you. He's read the Atlantic story. He's read the Brookings report. The stuff that they talk about is going to be in the speech and going to be in the approach. So what I'm talking about is not so far out of political reality.
How specific did they get with you about what's going to be in the speech?
Not so specific. They swore to me on Wednesday they'd get more specific.
But the if we take that comparative effectiveness research and then implement it, as you say, again, that comes back to exactly what the Republicans are opposing. They're saying we don't want Medicare to take government-sponsored comparative effective research and then force it down seniors' throats as rationing.
Right. And to me, that's just ridiculous. We have this thing called this MedCap, this board, which every year creates these proposals to how to make Medicare more efficient. They send their proposals up to Capitol Hill, where they every year, every other year, quietly die, and that's part of the problem of the current system. And I would say, if I could get a little partisan, that this is a government-run healthcare system, that when we have government-run healthcare system, you're going to have politics involved. And that's one of the reasons Medicare has a minimal control cost better than anybody else.
David Brooks on WNYC. Before you go, any quick thoughts on the president's education speech coming up at noon today and the pockets of resistance to exposing kids to it, saying he wanted to indoctrinate them in socialism or whatever? I'm not even sure I believe this story about people actually keeping their kids home from school today to avoid the speech.
Yeah, I think it was a mistake to read the Communist Manifesto. That was probably going a little too far. No, he's not. We'll see if This is one of those stories that I'm sure there are some wackos who think he's going to preach socialism. But to be perfectly honest, I think this story has been blown way out of proportion by people who want to feel superior to the yahoos in middle America. So I'm not sure how big a deal it is. I mean, First President Bush spoke to students. If Obama wants to speak to students and say nice things about staying in school, that strikes me as perfectly fine.
And maybe the people who would so object don't have their kids in public school anyway. I don't know. But I read the speech text. I presume you did. And it's all about the personal responsibility of the students. It's like your parents may abandon you. Your school may make a hash out of education. But it's still your job, kid, to buckle down and do your homework. And I know you wrote about the importance of character in your column today. But is this speech almost too simplistically like it's all on you, kids?
Well, that's a good message. And I'm not sure, you know, it's simplistic. It's to school children. But if you graduate from high school, if you don't have kids until you're married, you won't live in poverty. That's just the simple truth of it. And so whatever one circumstance, if you can do those two things, your life chances are much better. And that's just a simple truth. And it does touch on individual responsibility.
New York Times columnist David Brooks, thanks so much for doing this with us today.
Oh, thank you. Always a pleasure.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Of course, we will carry President Obama's health reform speech before a joint session of Congress live on Wednesday night. And coming up next, we will ask if there is a right and a left in the New York City controller election. Stay with us.